For another perspective on ovarian cancer, I met with Dr. Maury Markman, who I had not seen since 1992 when I interviewed him for the first time. 15 years later, Dr. Markman is still a candid, straight-shooting, and very knowledgeable investigator.
The situation with ovarian cancer is that there has been modest but not substantial changes over the last decade, a decade and a half. The landmark studies revealing that the addition of paclitaxel to platinum therapy certainly showed that one could improve the outcome in primary chemotherapy of the disease, and that was very positive. But in the last decade, there have been multiple studies that have looked at other drugs added to platinum and paclitaxel that have not shown an improvement in survival. So there have been studies that have looked at adding epirubicin, or studies adding topotecan, or studies adding liposomal doxorubicin or gemcitabine. Survival has not been improved. We, on the other hand, have shown that we can make some substitutions that impact on toxicity. So we now certainly, rather than using cisplatinum, when we're talking about intravenous therapy, most oncologists will use carboplatin. And carboplatin and cisplatinum are essentially equivalent in efficacy in ovarian cancer. But carboplatin is certainly preferred agent from the perspective of the toxicity, overall quality of life. And very importantly, since the taxanes are also neurotoxic as the platinums, if one gives cisplatinum and paclitaxel, or cisplatinum and docetaxel, you can certainly do it. It's not a question of whether it's possible to do, but it's more complicated. In fact, generally have to give paclitaxel either as a 24-hour infusion or separate it by a day from the cisplatinum because of the risk of neuropathy. And that's not necessary if you give carboplatin. So ease of administration, less toxicity, less nausea and vomiting, you know, clearly the preference is for carboplatin, but there's no improvement in outcome.
Let's dissect out a little bit about where we are right now in terms of stage of presentation in the United States.
That hasn't changed.
So what's the fraction right now?
70% of patients, maybe higher, will present with stage 3 or stage 4 disease.
The rest?
There'll be a small percentage that present with so-called stage 2, which is really somewhat of a myth in that if it really means either the patient was inappropriately staged or inadequately staged, or in fact, the patient really has early stage 3 disease, meaning that you can't find the disease in the upper abdomen, but you have to consider that at risk. There's probably 10% of patients who would present for reasons that we don't know if it's luck, we don't know if it's biology. There's currently no evidence at all that we can actually do anything ourselves to detect the disease early. It'll be because a woman might have a cyst and go into the doctor.
Right.
But again, one of the problems is we don't know that. Well, was it luck that we found it early, or was it in fact the biology of the disease such that it was growing very, very slowly, spreading very slowly, and yes, there was a symptom, but in fact that tumor was just almost destined to have a relatively good prognosis.
What fraction of women are presenting with actual metastatic disease?
Oh, the vast majority is probably 80, maybe 90%.
And what's the usual therapy in that situation?
Well, there are two approaches. The standard therapy is 6 cycles of carboplatin and paclitaxel, or carboplatin and docetaxel, based on the Scott Rock trial, again published many years ago, showing the equivalence of carboplatin and taxol, carboplatin and docetaxel. Again, one could certainly give cisplatin and taxol. It's not inferior therapy, it's just more toxic. So the standard would basically today be one of those three: cisplatin and taxol, carboplatin and taxol, or carboplatin and docetaxel.
And what's the prognosis for those women?
60 to 80%. Of patients will respond, and depending upon we actually, in the ovarian cancer area, really talk less about the stage of the disease in advanced disease and more on the amount of disease that is present when you start chemotherapy. So we talk about optimal or suboptimal residual disease. So for those women who have again, has been defined as optimal residual. Optimal is a term that is used, and obviously it's a debatable question as how do you define optimal, but the gynecologic oncology group would define that as the largest tumor mass present within the peritoneal cavity at the end of primary surgical site reduction is less than a centimeter. Those women now have a median survival in excess of 5 years, and in the most recent trial that looked at intraperitoneal cisplatinum, that median survival was considerably in excess of 5 years. With the median progression-free survival in that setting, probably in the order of 2.5 years, something like that. Now, in the more advanced disease setting, the suboptimal disease, the median survival is somewhere around 3 years, with a progression-free survival about 1.5 years.
And when you say metastatic disease, where are the metastatic disease?
The vast majority of women with ovarian cancer diagnosis will have disease that is spread throughout the peritoneal cavity. There are certainly women that will have disease in the liver, they'll have disease in the lung. That is the minority at presentation. What we also know, the natural history of the disease is changing somewhat in that later in the course, there are more evidence of metastatic disease outside the peritoneal cavity, particularly, interestingly enough, in the brain. And that is really because of the, I mean, again, speculation is that with longer survival, there's a greater opportunity for the disease to behave in manner that it would not have otherwise behaved. And it's presumably, again, hypothesis that there are growth factors that are required for the growth of the tumor that are present in the peritoneal cavity, and that these cancers either lose their requirements for these growth factors to be able to grow elsewhere, or that these factors, the stroma, that may have it present in other parts of the body later.
You know, talking about things that don't change, I think I can remember being an oncology fellow and thinking how weird it is to be doing surgery in people that you leave disease behind. And you just wrote an editorial in the JCO about kind of this issue. Can you talk about your thoughts there?
Well, you know, ovarian cancer is a very interesting malignancy, obviously, from the perspective of its really extraordinary chemotherapy sensitivity. And that's been recognized for a long time in that, as I said, 60 to 80% of patients achieve a major objective response. And if one were, in fact, to do second-look laparotomies on women routinely, now that was done in the past, is not done now, but we have a lot of data on that. Women who have optimal residual ovarian cancer, again, as I said, that's the largest tumor mass, less than a centimeter, fully half of those women would have no evidence of disease at the time of a second-look surgical procedure. And what I mean by that is if you went in, the surgeon saw nothing, they do biopsies, they would see nothing, the pathologist would find nothing. So this is exquisitely chemotherapy sensitive.
Essentially path CR?
Yes. So on the one hand, this is a remarkably sensitive disease. On the other hand, the vast majority of these patients are not cured. So if you, for example, contrast ovarian cancer to, you know, perhaps inappropriate only because we're talking about a different malignancy, that is hematologic malignancies. But if you look at individuals with a diffuse histiocytic lymphoma, you know, very bad prognosis, a high response rate, but a substantial percentage of those patients, when they achieve a CR, are cured. And that simply doesn't happen in ovarian cancer anywhere near that extent. And, you know, of course, the $64 billion question is why. So because of this chemotherapy sensitivity, and because of the fact that the disease was recognized many, many years ago to have, in retrospective studies, a better prognosis if there were smaller disease when you started chemotherapy, the standard approach from the gynecologic cancer community has been to go in and try to resect as much disease as possible prior to administration of chemotherapy. And there's very, very strong retrospective data to support this, so that if you look at study after study, meta-analysis after meta-analysis, you'll see that those women who start chemotherapy with the smallest volume disease, including down to what is now called zero volume or no residual disease, before you start chemotherapy, their prognosis is better. The problem with all of these analyses, of course, is that there has never been a randomized trial that's looked at the question of chemotherapy alone or chemotherapy followed by surgery, the so-called neoadjuvant approach, versus standard surgery followed by chemotherapy. Part of the issue is that people have said that it's really not ethical to do such a study, at least in the United States. That statement has been made because we know the prognosis. We know, that's the statement, we know that the prognosis is better if you have smaller volume disease. On the other hand, what I would add to that is that, in fact, the morbidity associated with the surgeries today done in the hands of extremely competent surgeons, the gynecologic oncologists, is very low. I mean, between the skills, the hospitals where this is done, the surgical technology, antibiotics.
They can't do this laparoscopically, can they?
Sometimes they can, certainly in the smaller settings, and certainly you go in and say the disease is not resectable. I'm not a surgeon, so I'm certainly not going to comment on the surgical abilities or surgical skills or surgical techniques. But it is no question that women could be undergoing a major operation, can be out of the hospital in a few days, be back and walking around, and again, prophylaxis for DVTs, things like that makes this, you know, the morbidity and mortality associated with this really quite acceptable. So on the one hand, we don't have definitive data showing the value of surgery first. On the other hand, we have a relatively, truly a safe procedure from the perspective of mortality. So to that extent, clearly this is a different approach than bone marrow transplantation. That being said, as you noted in my editorial, my challenge in this editorial was not to question either surgical skills or to say that, you know, the GYN oncology community has been wrong for the last 30 years, but to raise a note of caution because increasingly there are statements in the literature that say that optimal residual ovarian cancer is not a centimeter or less. It means there is no residual disease, which implies that you have to do a much more aggressive surgery in many women, much more extensive, and potentially considerably greater morbidity and even mortality. And my statement is that, very straightforward, it was a challenge to the GYN oncology surgical community that if that is true, and it may be true, I have no reason to say it is or isn't because we don't have data, that we should prove that. In other words, if it is true that this kind of an operation, this aggressive type of an operation, which would include a resection of disease in the liver, taking out spleens, major bowel resections, resecting part of the diaphragm, maybe even going into the lung, you know, whatever may take these aggressive operations, if in fact women with ovarian cancer survive significantly longer undergoing that kind of operation, that should become the standard of care. And that's what women and GYN oncologists should be prepared to do, or general surgeons should be prepared to do. Hospitals should be prepared to do, and individuals who can't do that safely and effectively, quite frankly, shouldn't be doing these kinds of operations. But if that is not true, if it is not true that those operations have an impact, then we shouldn't be saying that survival is improved with these kinds of operations. And the only way to answer this question is a well-designed prospective phase 3 randomized trial. And my study challenged the GYN oncology community to come up with a design. And it's complicated because it's a surgical issue, not a chemotherapy issue. How do you define the operation? You know, what is the randomization and when do you do it, for example? But I would argue that we need to ask this kind of question, the surgical community needs to ask this kind of question, because it is increasingly a question because there is an alternative. And the alternative is to argue that we should make a diagnosis of ovarian cancer, perhaps with laparoscopic surgery, use effective chemotherapy, which is a platinum and a taxane today, and then after, let's say, 3 cycles in a responding patient, perform an attempt at a surgical cytoreduction, which data would show in the far higher percentage of patients, you were able to get patients with zero volume disease, and then go on and give further chemotherapy. This is the so-called neoadjuvant approach. And this has been accepted by some surgeons, not by the majority in the United States. There's actually a prospective randomized trial on, that has finished accrual in Europe. We won't have data for several years on survival, as I understand this. EORTC did this study, looking at a neoadjuvant approach versus surgery first, followed by chemotherapy. That study turns out, for example, to show no difference in outcome. Again, it will challenge the question of doing aggressive surgery in all patients initially.
So just to be clear, are you questioning the issue of any surgery or just the extent of surgery?
No, it's the extent. This is, again, people ask me, what do I do if I saw a patient? I have immense respect for my surgical colleagues. I have respect for their skills. I have respect for their judgments. I've had the opportunity to work at 4 major institutions in this country in my career, and I've not met better, more conscientious, more competent individuals than the GYN oncologists I work with. So it has nothing whatsoever to do with their abilities. I'm simply saying there's options or strategies that need to look at. So quite frankly, I would simply, if I had a patient that I saw before surgery and had a lot of disease, I would turn to my surgical colleagues and say, what do you think? If you believe in this particular situation, based on physical findings, comorbid conditions, CAT scan finding, CA125, whatever you believe, you can go in and take basically all this disease out with relatively limited morbidity, then great, you do it. Because as I said, those patients can do very well. They can be out of the hospital in a few days and starting chemotherapy. But I would argue, if there's a question about that, that, you know, doesn't it make sense to, if we don't have a diagnosis yet, I mean, no one has even had an evaluation based upon, let's say, physical exam or CA125, you need to have some tissue to make that diagnosis. Make the diagnosis, whether it's laparoscopically or ascites or some other way. Give chemotherapy initially, and after several cycles, assuming the patient's responded. Because if there's been no response, then you could argue, why would you operate? And then go in and attempt to do that surgery. So right now, what I'm saying, it's a pragmatic approach. It's what do you think you can do? But unfortunately, the surgeons are in the same position I am. I don't know which approach is better because we haven't done that trial. The story with targeted therapies and molecular markers, markers of resistance in ovarian cancer is sort of in a state of turmoil. While ovarian cancer, as I noted, and oncologists certainly realize this is a highly chemotherapy-sensitive malignancy, one would have predicted, based upon that, that when we found targeted therapies that work against certain molecular targets, if anything, they would work better in ovarian cancer than they would work in other tumors, just on the basis of what we know about chemotherapy. I mean, that's a gross oversimplification of complicated issues, but gee, you know, all these drugs work in ovarian cancer. Why wouldn't they work there? Well, that has turned out not to be the case so far. So, for example, Herceptin, which in the early studies, one looked at HER2 overexpression. Ovarian cancer seemed to overexpress this often, some of the early studies, just as much as breast cancer. It seemed to be a poor prognostic factor in breast cancer. One would have thought, well, that Herceptin, trastuzumab, should be a pretty active drug. Well, it turns out, in a large study performed by the Gynecologic Oncology Group, only 11% of ovarian cancer patients overexpressed, which was considerably lower than one might have predicted. But in the setting even of the patients who overexpressed, there was a 7% response rate. So if you take a relatively uncommon disease, which ovarian cancer is certainly compared to breast, you take an incidence of 10%, and then in a setting where you might have thought you'd see some activity, you have a 7% response rate. It gets you to a pretty small population who might benefit. Then you ask, well, then, you know, how about doing it with chemotherapy? It becomes very difficult to even ask the questions when you have those kinds of populations.
What about pertuzumab?
Okay, well, obviously, there are always, of course, lessons learned in all of these things. Obviously, the pertuzumab story followed the Herceptin story. The pertuzumab is very interesting. Here, in this particular situation, the trial that was looked at, actually, the pertuzumab was given with this, it was a randomized trial, randomized phase 2 trial. There were some single agent studies, but a randomized phase 2 trial looking at gemcitabine. Complicated study looking at various markers, looking at not only HER2 overexpression, but relative percentage of HER2, HER3, all these various, in other words, these markers were done. And there was a suggestion that a particular pattern of expression of a molecular marker, not just overexpression of HER2, might predict response. But not even response in this case. One was looking at time to disease progression. So, you know, again, trying to be a little more, you might say, sophisticated or sensitive to the question that you might not see tumor shrinkage. And there was some suggestion of possible benefit. This is going to, in my understanding, is going to be pursued with further studies with pertuzumab. But again, I'll emphasize some of the difficulty here is that we are talking about a patient population that is fortunately relatively small. The data on the pertuzumab is that it may delay tumor progression. And in a randomized phase 2 trial, there was a suggestion that there was substantial delay in tumor progression, but it was a small study subset analysis. My own feeling is the drug absolutely needs further investigation, and I think that is the plan. What happens inside the tumor is not at all clear, because that relates to the question of EGFR. There were several EGFR inhibitors that have been looked at in ovarian cancer, and in fact, a very large percentage of ovarian cancers overexpressed EGFR. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the percentage might be even 70% or higher. And again, the
what
study...
What specifically has been studied?
I believe Iressa has been studied, Tarceva has been studied.
Cetuximab?
That has been studied, yes, with carboplatin, and matuzumab has also been studied. And in all those cases, either there was no evidence of response or very low evidence of response, or whatever parameters they used, which might have been, say, for example, time to disease progression compared to historical control. None of these are randomized trials. But disappointing levels of activity. And I would emphasize, again, to emphasize the complexity, it turned out in one of the studies, the ERISA study performed by the GOG, it was a beautiful study in that they actually tried to look not only at response and time to progression, but also look at molecular abnormalities. They did actually have one responder. One responder had that, but it was one patient out of a study of a large number of patients. You can say that is a very low response rate in a uncommon disease, and you ask, does that make sense? So if you turn to the one targeted therapy where there has been very surprising level of activity, it only is more complexing. And that, of course, relates to the experience with bevacizumab. So here, again, conventional wisdom doesn't appear to be necessarily the case in ovarian cancer. The experience with bevacizumab in a number of tumors is that the objective response rate of the drug as a single agent, if you look at tumor shrinkage by RECIST criteria, is relatively low. I think the number is something like 4% in colon cancer, but certainly a level that one would have said is pretty low in the low single figures. And basically one would say, well, you know, that's similar to background. Although for that, you know, one patient, it was probably very positive. So it would have been predicted based upon that the activity RECIST, measured by RECIST in ovarian cancer of bevacizumab would be similarly quite low. And in fact, in the GOG trial, the first trial they performed of bevacizumab in recurrent ovarian cancer, their primary endpoint was progression-free survival. And there was a phase 2 study, but what they did was they had a historical population where they predicted the percentage of patients who would have progressed by 6 months, and they prospectively defined a percentage of patients was higher than that. And they said, well, if a higher percentage of patients haven't progressed, that's encouraging. But they felt they looked at objective response rate as a sort of as a secondary response and didn't really think they'd see much of it. So what did they see? It was somewhere like a 20% objective response rate in recurrent And now we actually have data in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. Totally unexpected. And in fact, this would make bevacizumab, you know, again, no randomized trials comparison, makes it as active a drug as any cytotoxic we have in the platinum-resistant setting. So here we go. Here's a situation where we say, oh, this is a targeted therapy. This is a therapy that shouldn't cause tumor shrinkage. It's going to prevent the disease from growing. Clearly, bevacizumab only works with chemotherapy. And in ovarian cancer, we have evidence it's as good a single agent as other drugs. We see tumor shrinkage. Now, it turned out that the primary endpoint in that study was also met, meaning a delayed progression. But the fact is, it looked just like a cytotoxic from the perspective of its activity. So that's a rhetorical question. What does that mean? And how should we give bevacizumab? Should we give it as a single agent? Should we give it in combination?
What do we know about Bev with chemo and ovarian cancer?
What we know is there are no randomized trials. What we know is you can give bevacizumab in the second-line setting with chemotherapy. There are some people that say that the response rates are higher, but that has very little meaning because there haven't been randomized trials. I mean, in colon cancer, for example, if you could say, gee, if you see any activity at all, it must be the combination because bevacizumab by itself doesn't cause much tumor shrinkage. In ovarian cancer, that's not true at all. It's a high response rate. So that question has to be answered.
Sounds a little bit like renal in a way.
Well, it may be, but you know, the hypothesis here, again, is that, well, there's tremendous VEGF overexpression. And therefore, that's why there's a high response rate. But in other tumors where there's high VEGF overexpression, there isn't as high a response rate. And there's been all kinds of speculation as to why bevacizumab is so active. I should add that bevacizumab seems to be particularly effective. And this is not, you know, again, none of this is randomized control trial data. None of this is, you know, it's gone to the FDA for any kind of indications. I'm just simply saying these are experiences of oncologists and a little bit of data in the literature. It is particularly effective in controlling malignant ascites. And that's a little tricky because obviously chemotherapy is effective in controlling malignant ascites. So if a patient responds to chemotherapy, ascites goes away. So I'm talking about that subset of patients who have very advanced disease and refractory disease who are growing and not responding and they have ascites. There are anecdotal, but it's a lot of anecdotal data that says if you give bevacizumab, the tumor may not shrink. Or I mean, it may not have what you would call an objective response, but the ascites is well controlled in some of these patients for a long period of time.
What about the tumor markers? Do you see them drop?
You do, but you often can see tumor markers drop and the patients don't get better. But the point I wanted to make is this raises the question that what we're actually seeing with bevacizumab in ovarian cancer and perhaps in other tumors, but clearly in ovarian cancer, the hypothesis is this is less of an effect on the cells directly and more of an effect on interstitial edema, interstitial pressure. And what you're actually seeing when you see tumor shrinkage is an effect on the tumor environment, and you're actually seeing a lot of reduction in edema, interstitial edema in those masses. Fluid is going down.
And so you think that's what's going on or you know what's going
on? No, it's a hypothesis. But it could explain why we see, well, why would ascites get better? Because ascites is obviously a process that is both increased production and decreased reabsorption. So if lymphatic channels are being opened up, if there is...
Yeah, but isn't it usually more that there's a sort of cells growing in the soup rather than some type of, you know, hydrostatic thing?
Nobody really knows.
Really? I mean, you stick a needle in there, there's cells growing.
Oh, yeah, there's cells, but because there's cells, that doesn't tell you why the patient has ascites.
I mean, I always thought it was like in a petri dish and, you know, there's nothing around them and there's a higher growth fraction, which I always thought that was
But it's a question of why isn't the body able to reabsorb the ascites and why does the ascites keep forming? Because if you have lots of cells, there's in the vast majority of patients with ovarian cancer are going to have ascites and they're going to have cells in it and they don't have intractable ascites. Why is there intractable ascites? Why?
So you think it's a vascular type or interstitial thing or something?
It's a question of increased decrease. And again, it's a question of, because we know it has effect on the vasculature itself, and this obviously could be effect on the microenvironment, the vasculature, the whatever this is. This could also explain why, for example, bevacizumab seems to be additive to or synergistic with chemotherapy, because what it's doing, it is allowing, if it decreases interstitial pressure in the environment, in the microenvironment, and allows higher concentrations of drug to get to the tumor, they could also cause more tumor cell kill. This is completely speculative, but it is an interesting hypothesis that obviously makes some sense. Now, the other, just to complete the story on the bevacizumab, is that there are two large randomized trials now being conducted, one in the United States and one in Europe, looking at bevacizumab in combination with chemotherapy as primary therapy of ovarian cancer.
What's the exact eligibility design?
In the United States, it is patients with advanced ovarian cancer. It's a three-arm trial. The patients are getting carboplatin and Taxol as a primary therapy, as one arm, standard arm. Carboplatin and Taxol, bevacizumab, and the bevacizumab is stopping at the end of chemotherapy at the second arm, and the third arm is carboplatin, Taxol, bevacizumab, and the bevacizumab is continued for a substantial number of months after that in the third arm. I don't remember the exact number of months. And this is a placebo-controlled trial, so all patients who are not getting the bevacizumab are getting placebo.
Yeah, it's interesting, this idea how long you use the Bev. The only other trial I can think of, or major U.S. trial that's kind of like that, is the new adjuvant breast trial, which right. is the ECOG's doing.
Yeah, this is an important study because it actually is directly addressing the question of the maintenance strategy.
A lot of people have questions about that.
And this is important in ovarian cancer because even though, as I said earlier, a very large percentage of patients develop recurrence, the fact is that women can live for a very long period of time. So that if you're going to have someone alive 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 10 years, you want to know how long you have to continue the bevacizumab. This is not a disease where most people die within, you know, say 6 months.
What about toxicity with Bev and ovarian cancer and side effects?
Well, clearly the experience in ovarian cancer with bevacizumab had the advantage of knowing what the experience has been in other tumor types. So there was a lot of course, knowledge about controlling hypertension, and that has become pretty standard to make sure if someone's hypertensive, you control the hypertension before you start, or certainly exactly at the same time if you need to start right away. There had been experience, of course, with bevacizumab and the risk of bowel perforations, in particularly as relates to GI cancers. And clearly the issues of some issues with bleeding and healing had been evident in squamous cell cancers of the lung. But it did come as somewhat of a surprise in the second study, a phase 2 study of single-agent bevacizumab that was conducted. It was actually a company-sponsored study to look at, basically to confirm the GOG trial, as I said, which was about a 20% objective response rate. The company-sponsored a study on its own with obviously an indication for a potential secondary indication based on phase 2 data. But in this study, in contrast to the GOG study, and I'll say in a moment what possibly was the difference, the study had to be stopped. And although there was, again, about a 20% response rate in a highly resistant population, there was about a 10% incidence of bowel perforations. Now, there's some people who have said, oh, well, you know, this is ovarian cancer, bowel perforations, you know, you see that. Well, that's simply not true. We see very commonly obstruction, but actual perforation, which was seen here, including death, is not common.
And these were clinically problematic because the initial thought that seemed to be coming out of the colon study was, yeah, these perforations occur, but it's not like that, you know, it's a lot of them resolve on their own, et cetera. What about an ovarian?
Well, you know, see, the problem is it's some of that may be true, but you have to look at the population you were treating here. Because remember, these were not early diagnosis. This was not initial surgery. These were patients with very advanced disease in this trial. Extensive intra-abdominal disease.
Right.
So
maybe a tumor response going on?
No. I mean, again, and even if you did, it would have been a minimal response of a lot of disease.
But what I'm saying is the idea sort of coming out of lung cancer that maybe if you have a lot of tumor in the belly, you get a response, you sort of open up some holes?
Well, that is obviously a possibility. But here one could argue that there is such extensive disease that what's happening is that there's a lot of bowel in contact with tumor and there's sort of a you'd say a tug of war between the tumor invading the bowel and the body's ability to prevent these microperforations. And the bevacizumab in somebody who's got all of this disease in the abdomen sort of tips the balance against the body's natural reserve. Because you see, that was not seen. That incidence of perforation was not seen in the GOG trial. Same dose of bevacizumab, but the difference was those patients were not nearly, although they had recurrent disease, they had advanced disease, it wasn't the extensiveness. And so again, these are not randomized trial data, but the populations were really very, very extensive. And then even in subsequent studies, people have said, well, we don't see a 10% incidence. In the GOG trial now, for example, and many people say is, okay, if you have ovarian cancer patient, and you do an operation, and you're going to use bevacizumab, don't give it the first course. Give it the second course. In other words, the healing will have occurred. They
right,
go in and
right.
have, and then immediately start bevacizumab. Not
right,
a good idea.
Right.
The idea is that if you have somebody with extensive intra-abdominal disease, and if they're not going to be chemotherapy responsive, meaning you give them chemotherapy and they get better, that's great, then start bevacizumab. But if they have a really extensive disease, it's probably not a good idea.
Just to sort of finish up on Bev right now, we obviously have evidence that it is useful either as a single agent or with chemo. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so. My own feeling
is. And which chemo?
One doesn't know because just like the data in other tumor types, not all chemotherapy may work or maybe the tumor type. I'm hoping that the GOG trial will obviously answer that, at least with carboplatin. I personally feel in the resistance setting that the thing to do is since we have evidence the drug is active by itself, we don't have evidence that combination chemotherapy with it is better. I would absolutely give bevacizumab by itself.
You had a pretty, how can I put it, energetic letter to the editor about a paper looking at care given by GYN oncologists and medical oncologists for ovarian cancer. And can you comment little bit on what's actually happening in the United States in terms of who takes care of these people and what your thoughts were about this study and the issue of kind of how the, what the differences are?
Well, the study was profoundly silly. And,
why don't you just say what you think?
Well, basically, it was remarkable. But be that as it may, basically, the study took SEER data and concluded there was more morbidity, more toxicities, bone marrow suppression, whatever, in the patients who received therapy from the medical oncologist. This is, you know, completely somebody's opinion based on no data and is not helpful. And as I said in my paper, and as I said earlier in this interview, GYN oncologists are spectacular doctors. They're spectacular people. They have an unbelievable loyalty to their patients and to their subspecialty, and they are to be honored and respected for what they do. They are surgeons who basically really care about all aspects of the care, all the way down to palliative care. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a role for medical oncologists in the area.
What do you think the ideal way is for the medical oncologists and GYN oncologists to work together on patients?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously I could tell you it's the way I've done it in my career, but that's just one model.
What is that model?
And the model is basically the GYN oncologists, depending upon what their interests, their skills, and the support services they have around them, meaning, you know, are their medical oncologists interested in GYN cancers, to work together. I mean, one could argue that with the 10, 15, 20 different types of drugs that are now available, that it becomes more difficult for an individual or a group of doctors who are trying to be, you know, the proverbial captain of the ship, being in the operating room, taking care of these patients, being available for, you know, pain management, everything that goes into this, to be an expert on all of these things. And that the idea that a medical oncologist, who, remember, is going to also have to be taught about the disease because they're not the experts that GYN oncologists are, brought into that group. And I don't mean brought into the practice, but brought into the discussions, brought into the tumor boards, learned about the disease, and they can work together as a team. So one can argue as a model is that, you know, primary chemotherapy would be given, quote, by the GYN oncologist, secondary therapy be given by the medical oncologist.
Sort of could be like prostate cancer in terms of the urologist doing the surgery and then the primary endocrine therapy and then maybe handing the patient off.
Yeah, I mean, there are all of those models. I think the key here is that in any individual environment for medical oncologists and GYN oncologists to be working together in terms of optimizing the care for patients, to me, is the way to proceed. Now, you know, again, certain communities may not have that option. There may not be any GYN oncologists. Or in another community, there may not be any medical oncologists who are particularly interested. But if that is a possibility, I would argue that that will take advantage of both subspecialties.
I want to get back to stage three disease, but just the final issue, because there's so many things to talk about here. But basically, what do you see as the algorithm for management of the patient with metastatic disease as they progress along the way? First, second, third, fourth line systemic approach?
Well, I think that, you know, clearly the question of surgery becomes first, is primary chemotherapy followed by surgery after you make a diagnosis, the so-called neoadjuvant approach versus primary surgery. And then for those patients who have small volume residual disease, I think the option of intraperitoneal chemotherapy, unless there's contraindications, has to be considered standard of care now based upon three prospective randomized trials showing a survival advantage. That does not mean all patients in that setting have to get intraperitoneal therapy. I've never said that, nor can you say that. It is just an option that has to be considered. And if the patient has large volume disease, clearly systemic chemotherapy.
Can you be more specific about exactly what the regimen is that, say, you'd be likely to recommend to a patient in terms of intraperitoneal therapy and sort of how long the patient's treated and then what happens?
Well, you know, it's like a lot of other things in medicine and certainly in ovarian cancer, the definition of the optimal regimen is something that evolves over time and
it's
not necessarily defined. And I think right now, cisplatin at a dose of 75 milligrams per meter squared, IP, is a perfectly reasonable thing to give. One can give paclitaxel either as a 24-hour infusion or can be given as a 3-hour infusion if it is separated by one day from the platinum. So 135 to 175 milligrams per meter squared of paclitaxel given on day one and platinum given at 75 milligrams per meter squared on day two. And one can potentially either give or not give IP paclitaxel on day eight at 60 milligrams per meter squared and that on a 21-day schedule for six cycles. And if you can only give three of that, that's fine. And it's a perfectly reasonable regimen.
And what do you see in terms of side effects and toxicity?
There's no question that the side effects of that are related to the platinum. And if one's going to give platinum at 75 milligrams per meter squared, it's going to be vastly better than 100 milligrams per meter squared. There are also going to be the toxicities that are associated with a catheter. And there are going to be some patients who can't get IP therapy.
What specific toxicities with the catheter?
Well, just, you know, there's a risk of infection. There's clearly the risk that the catheter will not function.
What percent of patients sort of sail through it?
Well, that's a hard question to answer because it really depends upon the experience. I will tell you that the group at Memorial Sloan Kettering and the group at Johns Hopkins, where they've talked about, they've written about this, will tell you the vast majority of their patients can get through this. Now, sail through it is a different question. This is platinum. Nobody has ever said that anybody can sail through cisplatin.
What about local issues, though?
Usually, it's not a problem.
More systemic?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that, again, we got to keep remembering, we have been giving cisplatinum at a dose of 100 milligrams per meter squared. That is a very toxic regimen, nausea and vomiting. So if someone says, you know, they have abdominal discomfort, they've been vomiting probably too. Now, again, the group at Johns Hopkins is really, you know, still pushed 100 milligrams per meter squared. They are very aggressive with their antiemetic regimens. And today, our antiemetic regimens are much better, and they would argue the majority of patients get through it. I personally would not give 100 milligrams per meter squared because I do not believe today. In fact, we have very good evidence that the dose is not important with systemic platinum, and giving 75 milligrams per meter squared is perfectly fine.
When you give it intraperitoneally, how does it compare sort of the pharmacologically?
90 to 100% of the drug gets in the systemic
compartment. So it's almost the same as giving intravenously from a systemic point
of view. It is. We know that now. And the toxicities are the same. That's why you get all that toxicity systemically.
What's the level of benefit that's been demonstrated in the clinical trials?
Three randomized trials have now shown remarkably similar outcomes. There's a 20 to 30% relative improvement in survival. And it's all statistically significant. And, you know, as I said, in the last 10 years, there have been no positive trials in ovarian cancer for survival, but three prospective randomized trials performed by NCI cooperative groups that have shown survival, 20-30%. The most recent study showed a 16-month improvement in median overall survival associated with IP therapy.
How do you think people are getting treated if they're not getting this?
I think they're getting systemic therapy. Again, what I think is completely anecdotal. It's, you know what, you know, people come to see me or they call me. And they're...
That's amazing. They're not getting intraperitoneal therapy.
From a medical oncologist's perspective, if you've never given intraperitoneal therapy, the time and effort that might go into doing this may seem to be too much. From a GYN oncologist's perspective, it's probably going to be somewhat easier, but they still may not say it's worth it. Not a lot of patients. There's no pharmaceutical company interest in trying to educate people on how to do this because it's not a drug. It's a delivery strategy. And there's, of course, the issues of reimbursement. It's not that you don't get reimbursed for this. The question is the time and effort that goes into it. Is it justified? So these are all complicated issues. But the bottom line is patients who get intraperitoneal therapy in this setting have a 20 to 30% relative improvement in survival. And if our goal is to optimize therapy for our patients, it is inconceivable to me that one would not offer this therapy.
Let's just track out a little bit more about the algorithm, though, in terms of patients who do have progressive disease. What you see is sort of first, second, third, and fourth line therapy.
When there's evidence of recurrence, there is currently no evidence that any of the second line therapies, and that's everything after first line, the therapy is curative. We can certainly extend survival. We have two randomized trials that show that carboplatin combination therapies are superior to single-agent carboplatin. That's carboplatin taxol and carboplatin gemcitabine. They weren't compared to each other. They're compared to carboplatin. They improve outcome. We certainly know that there are a number of drugs, from liposomal doxorubicin to topotecan, gemcitabine, Avastin, as we've talked about, bevacizumab, and there are a number of other drugs, you know, vinorelbine, even hexamethylamine, ifosfamide, tamoxifen, have shown activities.
Tamoxifen?
10% objective response rate.
Are there ER receptors in ovarian cancer?
No, actually, we don't even know if it has to do with that. And these are older studies. But there are patients that benefit, and certainly there are patients relatively non-toxic. There are a dozen plus drugs that have activity. The reality is that when there's evidence of recurrence, the majority of patients today, certainly in the United States, will get 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different regimens. They may live, once they recur, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 plus years. I have talked about viewing this process as a chronic disease process. There's some people, particularly patients, that have challenged that because they feel that the word chronic negates the very difficult experience, both physical and emotional, psychological, they go through. That has never been my intent. My intent is simply to emphasize, like someone who has very, very bad diabetes. No one would ever say diabetes isn't a serious disease, but you can't cure it. But you can control it, and you can control it for long periods of time, and it requires continuous care, observation, thinking about it. And
chronic disease model.
Yeah, and again, it's a disease model. The key issue there with calling it chronic is to remember.
Breast cancer, too, same thing's been said.
Absolutely, and I think for other solid tumors, we have to begin to look at this. Because the key issue here is to remember what you do to a patient today –
colon
may not just affect them a week from now, but it may affect them a year from now.
Right.
Or 2 years from now. It may mean that they're going to have a neuropathy that doesn't go away. It may mean that they're going to have such bone marrow suppression that they're not going to be able to get chemotherapy in the future. It may mean that for certain drugs, there may be a risk of myelodysplasia and secondary acute leukemia if they're living long enough. You've got to think about those things, and you've got to think about quality of life issues. You know, giving therapy once a month or giving therapy orally is very different than asking somebody to come in 3 or 4 days in a row to get therapy. And again, if you're thinking about, well, the survival is going to be measured in weeks, you might say, well, it doesn't really matter. But if therapy is going to be measured in many months to years, because you're not going to stop. There's not evidence that we would cure the disease, but it's, again, this chronic disease model, severe rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, those diseases where you'd say, well, you know, really tough diseases and you'll get it under control and there'll be relapses. This is the thought process that I'm trying to discuss.
Well, the other thing, and you hear this in breast cancer, is you get into the sort of the endocrine therapy, the capecitabine, oral therapy, you know, sort of a step-like approach. I mean, if I think about all the 10 or 12 things that you listed, in terms of toxicity, I'd have Bev pretty high up on the list. In terms of lack of toxicity, yeah. I'd have Bev pretty high up. Is that something that you see turning to pretty early because of that?
Well, you know, again, one could argue that. One could argue that there are drugs like liposomal doxorubicin at 40 milligrams per meter squared once a month is a very well-tolerated drug. Topotecan, as long as you don't give it at 1.5 milligrams per meter squared a day for 5 days, if you give it perhaps now by the weekly schedule, although we don't have a lot of data, and now there's oral topotecan, that may be a very reasonable regimen. So I think, again, the idea here is you sort of take a drug that's been FDA approved, you figure out how to use it in this setting. The idea is to extend survival as long as possible to focus on the quality of life for the patients.